From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Incense of Abomination by C. Barry Quinn. Detective Sergeant Costello looked fixedly at the quarter inch of ash on his cigar, as though he sought solution of his problem in its fire-cored grayness. "'Tis the damnedest mixed-up mess I've ever happened up against," he told us solemnly. "Here's this Eldridge felly, young and rich and idle, with never a care to his name, savin' maybe, how he'd spend the next month's income. Then Zowie, he ups and hang himself. When I find him swinging from the doorpost of his bedroom, with his bathrobe girdle knotted around his neck, and about a mile of tongue sticking out. Suicide? Sure. And what else could it be with a fella found strung up in a tight-locked flat like that? Then, within a week, there comes a call for us to take it on the lamp up to the house where Stanley Trivers lived. There he is, laying on his bathroom floor with a cut across his throat that you could put your foot into, almost, in his pajamas. He is, and the blood's run down and spoilt them good and proper. Suicide again? Well, maybe so and maybe no. For an only time, I've ever seen a suicidal cut across a felly's throat that was as deep where it wound up as where it started. It mostly gets remorse afore the cut is ended, as you know, and the pressure on the knife gets less and less, so the cut's a whole lot shallower at the end than 'twas at the beginning. However, the coroner says it's suicide, so suicide it is, far as we're concerned. Anyhow, gentlemen, in both these cases the dead men was locked in their houses from the inside, as was plain by the key still being in the locks. Now comes the third one. 'Tis this Donald Atkins felly over to the Kensington apartments. Stretched on the floor he is, with a hole bored in his forehead, and the blood running over everything. He's on his back with a pearl stock pistol in his hand. Suicide again, says Schultz, me partner. And I'm not the one to say as how it ain't, all sides pointing as they do, still. He paused and puffed on his cigar, till its gray tip glowed with sullen rose. Jules de Grandin tweaked a needle-sharp mustache tip. "Tell me, my sergeant," he commanded, "what is it you have withheld? Somewhere in the history of these cases is a factor you have not revealed, some denominator common to them all which makes your police instinct doubt your senses' evidence." "How'd you guess it, sir?" The big Irishman looked at him admiringly. "You've put your finger right up on it, but—" He stifled an embarrassed cough, then, turning slightly red, "'Tis the perfume, sores, makes me wonder." "Perfume?" the little Frenchman echoed. "What in Satan's foul name?" "Well, sir, I ain't one of them as sees a woman's skirts a-hiding back of every crime. Though you and I both know there's mighty few crimes committed that ain't concerned with cash or women, saving when they're done for both. But these here cases have me worried. None of these men was married, and so far as I've found out, none of them was keeping steady company yet. Get this, sore, 'tis small, but maybe it's important. There was a smell of perfume hanging round each one of them, and 'twas the same in every case. No sooner had I got a look at this poor Eldridge felly, hanging like a joint of beef from his own doorpost, then me nose begins a twitching. Was he a pansy, maybe? I wonders when I smelt it first, for 'twas no shaving lotion or toilet water, but a woman's heavy scent, strong and sweetin', what's it that I'll say? Distinctive. Yes, sir, that's the word for it, distinctive. Not like anything I've smelt before, but kind of like mixing up this here, other that. They use to put a man to sleep before they take his leg off, and kind of like the incense they use in church. And maybe there was something mixed with it that wasn't perfume after all. Something that smelled rank and sickly-like. The kind of smell you smell when they takes a floater from the bay, sir. Well, I looks around to see where's it coming from. And it's strongest in the bedroom. But devil a sign of any woman being there I find, excepting for the smell of perfume. So, when we runs in on the Trivers suicide, and I smells the same perfume again, I say that this is something more than mere coincidence. But same thing happens here. The smell is strongest in the bedroom. But there ain't any sign that he'd had company the night before. So just to make sure, I takes the casings off both the pillows and has the boys at the crime laboratory look at 'em. Divil a trace of rouge or powder do they find. Both these other fellies killed themselves at night or early in the morning, so of course their beds was all unmade. But when we hustle over to the Kensington apartments to see about this Mr. Atkins, 'tis just past 3 o'clock. The doctor says that he's been dead an hour or more, yet when I goes into his bedroom, the covers is pushed down, like he's been slapping there and got up in a hurry, and the perfume is strong enough to knock you down, almost. The boys at the crime lab says there's not a trace of powder on the linen, and by the time I gets the pillows to him, the perfume's faded out. He looked at us with vaguely troubled eyes and ran his hand across his mouth. "'Tis myself that's going nuts about these suids a-coming, one on top of the other, and this perfume bobbing up in every case he finished." The grandin pursed his lips. "You would know this so strange scent if you encountered it again." "Faith, sir, I'd know it in me slip." "And you have never met with it before?" "Indeed, none. I had not. Neither before nor since, saving in the immaculate presence of them three dead corpses." One regrets it is so evanescent. "Perhaps, if I could smell it, I might be able to identify it. I recall when I was serving with Le Sirette, we came upon a band of scoundrels making use of a strange Indian drug called by the Hindus Chota Mat, or Little Death. It was a subtle powder which made those inhaling it go mad, or fall into a coma simulating death if they inspired enough. Those naughty fellows mixed the drug with incense, which they caused to be burned in the victims' rooms. Some went mad, and some appeared to die. One of those who went insane committed suicide." "Holy mither, and you think we may be up against a gang like that, sir?" "One cannot say, mon vieux. Had I a chance to sniff the scent, perhaps I could have told you. Its odor is not one that I is soon forgotten. As it is," he raised his shoulders in a shrug, "what can one do?" "Will you be, after holding yourself in readiness, to come a running if they's another of these suicides, sir?" the big detective asked, as he rose to say good night. "I'll take it kindly, if you would." "You may count on me, my friend, a bien tot," the little Frenchman answered with a smile. The storm had blown itself out earlier in the evening, but the streets were still bright with the filmy remnant of the sleety rain, and the moon was awash in a breaking surf of wind clouds. It was longer by the north road, but with the pavement slick as burnished glass, I preferred to take no chances and had throttled down my engine almost to a walking pace as we climbed the gradient leading to Northbridge. The grandin sank his chin into the fur of his upturned collar coat and nodded sleepily. The party at the Merivales had been not at all amusing, and we were due at City Hospital at 7 in the morning. "Ah, bah," he murmured drowsily. "We were a pair of fools, my friend. We forgot a thing of great importance when we left the house tonight. I grunted.
What?
To stay there, he returned. Had we but the sense, le bon Dieu gives an unfledged gosling, we should have. Sapristi.
Stop him. He is intent on self-destruction.
At his shattered warning, I looked towards the footwalk and descried a figure in a heavy ulster climbing up the guardrail. Shooting on my power, I jerked the car head, then cut the clutch and jammed the brakes down hard, swinging us against the curb abreast of the intending suicide. I kicked the door aside and raced around the Bien engine hood. But the Grandin disdained such delays and vaulted overside, half-leaping, half-sliding on the slippery pavement, and cannoning full tilt against the man who sought to climb the breast-high railing.
"Parbleu, you shall not!" he exclaimed as he grasped the other's leg with outflung arms.
"It is wet down there, monsieur, and most abominably cold. Wait for summer, if you care to practice diving." The man kicked viciously, but the little Frenchman hung undoggedly, and as the other loosed his hold upon the rail, they both came crashing to the pavement where they rolled and thrashed like fighting dogs. I hovered near the melee, intent on giving such assistance as I could, but my help was not required, for as I reached to snatch the stranger's collar, the Grandin gave a quick twist, arched his body upon neck and heels, and with a blow as rapid as a striking snake's, chopped his adversary on the Adam's apple with his stiffened hand. The result was instantaneous. The larger man collapsed as if he had been shot, and my little friend slipped out from underneath him, teeth flashing in an impish grin, small blue eyes agleam. A knowledge of jiu-jitsu comes in handy now and then, he panted as he rearranged his clothing. For a moment I had fears that he would take me with him to a watery bed.
Well, what shall we do with him? I asked. He's out completely, and we can't afford to leave him here.
He'll surely try to kill himself if...
Pablo, attendez, s'il vous plaît, he interrupted.
The perfume.
Do you smell him?
He paused, with back-thrown head, narrow nostrils quivering, as he sniffed the moist, cold air. There was no doubt of it. Faint, and growing quickly fainter, but plainly noticeable, the aura of a scent hung in the atmosphere. It was an odd aroma, not wholly pleasant, yet distinctly fascinating, seeming to combine the heavy sweetness of patchouli with the bitterness of frankincense, and the penetrating qualities of musk and civet. Yet underlying it there was a faint and slightly sickening odor of corruption.
Why, I never smelled, I began, but the Grandin waved aside my observation.
Nor I, he nodded shortly, but unless I am at fault, this is the perfume which the good Costello told us of. Can you not see, my friend? We have here our laboratory specimen, an uncompleted suicide with the redolence of this mysterious scent upon it. Help me lift them in the car. We have things to say to this one. We shall ask him by example why it was.
Suppose that he won't talk, I broke in.
Ha, you suppose that? It's your supposition proves correct, and he is of the obstinacy. You shall see a beautiful example of the third degree. You shall see me turn him inside out as if he were a lady's glove. I shall creep into his mind, me, I shall, mon Dieu. Before the night is done, I damn think I shall have at least a partial answer to the good Costello's puzzle. Come, let us be of haste and avant. Despite his height, the salvaged man did not weigh much, and we had no trouble getting him inside the car. In 15 minutes we were home just as our rescued human flotsam showed signs of returning consciousness.
Be careful, warned the Grandin, as he helped the passenger alight.
If you behave, we shall treat you with a kindness. But if you try the monkey's tricks, I have in readiness a second portion of the dish I served you on the Pont du Nord. Here, he added, as we led our captive to the study, this is the medicine for those who feel at odds with life. He poured a gill of Scots into a tumbler and poised the siphon over it.
We have soda with your whiskey, he inquired, or do you like it unpolluted?
Soda, please, the other answered sulkily, drained his glass in two huge gulps, and held it out again.
Ah, bien, the Frenchman chuckled. Your troubles have not dulled your appetite, it seems.
Drink, my friend, drink all you wish, for the evening is still young, and we have many things to talk of, thou and I. the visitor eyed him sullenly as he took a sip from his fresh glass. "I suppose you think you've done your Boy Scouts good deed for today," he muttered.
"Ma oui, ma certainement," the Frenchman nodded vigorously. "We have saved you from irreparable wrong, my friend. Le bon Dieu did not put us here to—"
"That's comic," the other burst out with a cackling laugh. "Le bon Dieu? Much use he has for me."
The Grand Dan lowered his arching brows a little. The effect was a deceptively mild, thoughtful frown.
"So," he murmured, "that is the way of it? You feel that you have been cast off, that—"
"Why not? Didn't we— I cast him out? Didn't I deny him? Take service with his enemies? Mock at him?"
"Be not deceived, my friend." The double line between the Frenchman's narrow brows was etched a little deeper as he answered, in an even voice, "God is not mocked. It is easier to spit against the hurricane than jeer at him. Besides, he is most merciful, he is compassionate, and his patience transcends understanding. Wicked we may be, but if we offer true repentance—"
"Even if you've committed the unpardonable sin?"
"Tiens. This peche et immiscible, of which the theologians prate so learnedly, yet which none of them defines. You had a mother, one assumes. You may have sinned against her grievously, disappointed her high hopes in you, shown ingratitude as black as Satan's shadow, abused her trust, or even done her bodily hurt. Yet, if you went to her sincerely penitent and told her you were sorry, that you truly loved her, and would sin no more, Pablu, she would forgive you. You know it. Will the Heavenly Father be less merciful than earthly parents? Very well, then. Who can say that he has sinned past reconciliation?"
"I can. I did. We all did. We cast God out and embraced Satan. Something that was lurking horror seemed to take form in his eyes, giving them a stony glazed appearance. It was as if a filmy curtain were drawn down across them, hiding everything within, mirroring only a swift mounting terror."
"Ah," the Grand Dan murmured thoughtfully, "now we begin to make the progress." Abruptly he demanded, "You knew Messieurs Eldridge, Trivers, and Atkins?" He flung the words more like a challenging accusation than a query.
"Yes."
"And they too thought that they had sinned past redemption. They saw in suicide the last hope of escape. They were concerned with you and this iniquity?"
"They were, but no interfering busybody stopped them. Let me out of here. I'm going to—"
Monsieur de Grandin did not raise his voice, but the look he bent upon the other was as hard and merciless as though it were a leveled bayonet. "You are going to remain right here and tell us how it came about. You will tell of the transgressions which has caused 3 deaths already and almost caused a 4th. Do not fear to speak, my friend. We are physicians, and your confidence will be respected. On the other hand, if you persist in silence, we shall surely place you in restraint. You would like to be lodged in a madhouse, have your every action watched, be strapped in a straitjacket if you attempted self-destruction. Bien?"
Slowly spoken, his words had the impact of a bodily assault, and the other reeled as from a beating.
"Not that," he gasped. "Oh God, anything but that. I'll tell you everything if you will promise."
"You have our word, monsieur. Say on."
The visitor drew his chair up closer to the fire as if a sudden cold had chilled his marrow. He was some 40 years of age, slim and quite attractive, immaculately dressed, well-groomed. His eyes were brown, deep-set and drawn, as if unutterably weary, with little pouches under them. His shoulders sagged as if the weight they bore was too much for him. His hair was almost woolly gray. Beaten was the only adjective to modify him.
"I think perhaps you knew my parents, Dr. Trowbridge," he began.
"My father was James Balderson."
I nodded. Jim Balderson had been a senior when I entered college, and his escapades were bywords on the campus. Nothing but the tolerance which stamps a rich youth's viciousness as merely indication of high spirits had kept him from dismissal since his freshman year,
and faculty and townsfolk sighed with relief when he took his sheepskin and departed simultaneously. The Balderson and Aldridge fortunes were combined when he married Bronson Aldridge's sole heir and daughter, and though he settled down in the walnut-paneled office of the Farmers Loan and Trust Company, his sons had carried on his youthful zest for getting into trouble. Drunken driving, divorce cases, scandals which involved both criminal and civil courts, were their daily fare. Two of them had died by violence, one in a motor smash-up, one when an outraged husband showed better marksmanship than self-restraint. One had died of poison liquor in the Prohibition era. We had just saved the sole survivor from attempted suicide. "Yes, I knew your father," I responded. "Do you remember Horton Hall?" he asked. I bent my brows a moment. "Wasn't that the school down by the Shrewsbury where they had a scandal? Something about the headmaster committing suicide or..." "You're right. That's it. I was in Die, last class there. So were Eldridge, Trivers, and Atkins. I was finishing my junior year when the war broke out in 17. Dad got bulletproof commissions for the older boys, but wouldn't hear of my enlisting in the Navy. 'You've a job to do right there at Horton,' he told me. 'Get your certificate, then we'll see about you joining up.' So back I went to finish out my senior year. Dad didn't know what he was doing to me. Things might have turned out differently if I'd gone in the service. Everyone who could was getting in the Army or the Navy. We lost most of our faculty when I went back in 18, and they put a new headmaster in, a Dr. Herbules. Fellows was leaving right and left, enlisting from the campus or being called by draft boards, and I was pretty miserable. One day, as I was walking back from science lab, I ran full tilt into old Herbules. 'What's the matter, Balderson?' he asked. 'You look as if you'd lost your last friend.' 'Well, I have, almost,' I answered. 'With so many fellows off at training camp, having all kinds of excitement.' 'You want excitement?' he interrupted. 'I can give it to you. Such excitement as you've never dreamed of. I can make you—' He stopped abruptly, and it seemed to me he looked ashamed of something, but he'd got my curiosity roused. 'Your answer,' I told him. 'What is it, a prize fight?' Hercules was queer. Everybody said so. He couldn't have been much past 30, yet his hair was almost snow white, and there was a funny set of peaceful expression on his smooth face that reminded me of something that I couldn't quite identify. He had the schoolmaster's trick of speaking with a sort of pedantic precision, and he never raised his voice. Yet when he spoke in chapel, we could understand him perfectly, no matter how far from the platform we were sitting. I'd never seen him show signs of excitement before, but now he was breathing hard and was in such deadly earnest that his lips were fairly trembling. 'What do you want most from life?' he asked me in a whisper. 'Why, I don't know. Just now, I'd like best of all to get into the army. I'd go to France and bat around with the mademoiselles and get drunk any time I wanted.' 'You'd like that sort of thing?' he laughed. 'I can give it to you, and more. More than you ever imagine. Wine and song and gaiety and women. Beautiful, lovely, cultured women. Not the street trolls that you'd meet in France. You can have it all, this and more, if you want to, Balderson.' 'Lead me to it,' I replied. 'When do we start?' 'Ah, my boy, nothing's given for nothing. There are some things you'll have to do, some promises to make, something to be paid.' 'All right, how much?' I asked. Dad was liberal with me, at $100 every month for spending money. I could always get as much again from Mother if I worked it right. 'No, no, not money,' he almost laughed in my face. 'The price of all this can't be paid in money. All we ask is that you give the master something, which I greatly doubt you realize you have, my boy.' It sounded pretty cockeyed to me, but if the old boy really had something up his sleeve, I wanted to know about it. 'Count me in,' I told him. 'What do I do next?' There was no one within 50 yards of us, but he bent until his lips were almost in my ear before he whispered, 'Next Wednesday at midnight, come to my house.' 'Private party, or could I bring a friend or two?' His features seemed to freeze. "Who is the friend?" he asked.
"Well, I'd like to bring Elridge and Trivers, and maybe Atkins, too. They're all pretty good eggs, and I know they crave excitement."
"Oh, by all means, yes. Be sure to bring them."
"It's agreed, then. Next Wednesday night at 12, at my house."
Hercules was waiting for us in a perfect fever of excitement when we tiptoed up his front porch steps on Wednesday night. He had a domino and mask for each of us. The dominoes were fiery red with hoods that pulled up like a monk's cowl. The masks were black and hideous. They represented long, thin faces with out-jutting chins. The lips were purple and set in horrid grins. The eyebrows were bright scarlet wool, and at the top there was another patch of bright red worsted, curled and cut to stimulate a fringe of hair.
"Good Lord," said Atkins as he tried his on, "I look just like the devil."
I thought that Hercules would have a stroke when he heard Atkins speak.
"You'll use that name with more respect after tonight, my boy," he said. After that, we all got in his car and drove down toward Red Bank. We stopped about a mile outside of town and parked the car in a small patch of woods, walked some distance down the road, climbed a fence, and cut across a field till we reached an old deserted house. I'd seen the place as I drove past, and had often wondered why it was unoccupied, for it stood up on a hill surrounded by tall trees and would have made an ideal summer home. But I'd been told its well was dry, and as there was no other source of water, nobody wanted it. We didn't go to the front door, but tiptoed round the back, where Hercules struck three quick raps, waited for a moment, then knocked four more. We'd all put on our robes and masks while he was knocking, and then the door was opened on a crack, and we saw the porter was robed and masked as we were. Nobody said a word, and we walked through a basement entrance, down a long and narrow hall, and turned a corner where we met another door. Here Hercules went through the same procedure, and the door swung back to let us in. We were in a big room, 20 by 40 feet, I guess, and we knew it was the cellar by the smell. Stiflingly close, but clammy as a tomb at once. Rows of folding chairs like those used at bridge games, or funerals, were arranged in double rows, with a passage like an aisle between, and at the farther end of the big room we saw an altar. And all my life, I don't believe I've been to church 10 times, but we were nominally Protestants, so what I saw had less effect on me than if I'd been a Catholic or Episcopalian. But I knew at once the altar wasn't regulation. Oh, it was sufficiently impressive, but it had a sort of grotesque note about it. A reredos of black cloth was hung against the wall, and before it stood a heavy table, more than 8 feet long and at least 6 wide, covered by a black cloth edged with white. It reminded me of something, though I couldn't quite identify it for a moment. Then I knew. I'd seen a Jewish funeral once, and this cloth was like the black serge pall they used to hide the plain pine coffin. At each end of the altar stood a 7-branch candelabrum made of brass, each with a set of tall black candles in it. These were burning and gave off a pale blue glow. They seemed to be perfumed too, and the odor which they burned, which was pleasant at first. Then, as I sniffed a second time, it seemed to me there was a faint suspicion of a stench about it, something like the fetor that you smell if you're driving down the road and pass a dog or cat that's been run over and has lain a while out in the sun. Just a momentary whiff, but nauseating just the same. Between the candelabra, right exactly in the center of the altar, but back against the wall, was a yard-high crucifix of some black wood with an ivory figure on it, upside down. Before the cross there was a silver wine goblet and a box of gilt inlay about the size and shape of a lady's powder puff box. I heard Atkins catch his breath and gave a sort of groan. He'd been brought up an Episcopalian, knew about such things. He turned half round to leave, but I caught him by the sleeve. "Come on, you fool, don't be a sissy," I admonished, and next moment we were all so interested that he had no thought of leaving. There was a sort of congregation in the chapel. Every seat was occupied by someone masked and robed, just as we were,
save 3 vacant places by the altar steps. These we knew were kept for us, but when we looked about for Hercules, he was nowhere to be seen. So we went forward to our seats, alone. We could hear a hum of whispering as we walked up the aisle, and we knew some of the voices were from women. But who was man and who was woman was impossible to tell, for each one looked just like his neighbor in his shrouding robe. The whispering suddenly became intense, like the surcimus of a hive of swarming bees. Every neck seemed suddenly to crane, every eye to look in one direction, and as we turned our glance toward the right side of the cellar, we saw a woman entering through a curtained doorway. She wore a long, loose scarlet cape, which she held together with one hand. Her hair was very black, her eyes were large and luminously dark, seeming to have a glance of overbearing sensuousness and sweet humility at once. Her white, set face was an imponderable mask. Her full red lips were fixed in an uneven, bitter line. Beneath the hem of her red cloak, we saw the small feet in the golden, high-heeled slippers were unstocking. As she neared the altar, she sank low in genuflection, then wheeled about and faced us. For a moment she stood there, felt graceful, mysteriously beautiful with that thin white face and scarlet lips, so like a mask. Then, with a sudden kicking motion, she unshod her feet, opened wide her cloak, and let it fall in scarlet billows on the dull black carpet of the altar steps. She was so beautiful, it almost hurt the eyes to look at her, as she stood there in white silhouette against the ebon background of the black-draped altar. With her narrow boy-like hips, slim thighs, and full high-pointed breasts, she was a thing of snow and fire, her body palely cool and virginal, her lips like flames, her eyes like embers blazing with a sudden wind stirs them to brightness. The modern striptease routine was unthought of in those days, and though I was sophisticated far beyond my 18 years, I had never seen a woman in the nude before. The flame of her raced in my blood and crashed against my brain with almost numbing impact. I felt myself go faint and sick with sudden weakness and desire. A long, drawn sigh came from the audience. Then the tableau was abruptly broken as the girl turned from us, mounted nimbly to the black-draped altar and stretched herself full length upon it, crossed her ankles and thrust her arms out right and left, so that her body made a white cross on the sable altar cloth. Her eyes were closed as though in peaceful sleep, but her bosoms rose and fell with her tumultuous breathing. She had become the altar. Silence fell upon the congregation like a shadow, and next instant Hercules came in. He wore priest vestments, a long red cassock, over it the alb and stole, and in his hand he bore a small red book. Behind him came his acolyte. But it was not an altar boy. It was a girl, slender, copper-haired, petite. She wore a short surcoat of scarlet, cut low around the shoulder, sleeveless, reaching just below the hips, like the tabards worn by medieval heralds. Over it she wore a lace-edged cotta. Otherwise, she was unclothed. We could hear the softly slapping patter of her small bare feet upon the altar sill as she changed her place from side to side, genuflecting as she passed the reverse crucifix. She swung a brazen censer to and before her, and the gray smoke curled and spurting puffs from it, filling the entire place with a perfume like that generated by the candles, but stronger, more intense, intoxicating. Hercules began the service with a muttered Latin prayer, and though he seemed to follow a set ritual, even I could see it was not that prescribed by any church, for when he knelt, he did so with his back turned toward the altar. When he crossed himself, he did it with the thumb of his left hand and made the sign beginning at the bottom rather than the top. But even in this mummer's parody, the service was majestic. I could feel its power and compulsion as it swept on towards its climax. Hercules took up the silver chalice and held it high above his head, then rested it upon the living altar, placing it between her breasts, and we could see the flesh around her nails grow white as she grasped the black-palled altar table with her fingers. Her body,
shining palely on the coffin pall. Under the flickering candle's light was arched up like a tattered bow. She shook as if a sudden chill had seized her, and from her tight-drawn scarlet lips there issued little whimpering sounds. Not cries, nor yet quite groans, but something which partook of both, and at the same time made me think of the soft, winning sounds a newborn puppy makes. The kneeling acolyte chimed a saccharine bell, and the congregation bent and swayed like a wheat field swept across by sudden wind. When all was finished, we were bidden to come forward and kneel before the altar steps. Hercules came down and stood above us, and each of us was made to kiss the red book, which he held, and take a fearful oath, swearing that he would abstain from good and embrace evil, serve Satan faithfully and well, and do his best to bring fresh converts to the worship of the devil. Should we in any manner break our oath, we all agreed that Satan might at once foreclose upon his mortgage on our souls, and bear us still alive to hell, and the sign that we were come for was to be the odor of the perfume which the candles in the censer gave that night. When this ritual was finished, we were bidden name our dearest wish, and told it would be granted. I could hear the others mumble something, but could not understand their words. I don't know what possessed me. When it came my turn to ask a boon of Satan, possibly he put the thought into my mind. Maybe it was my longing to get out of school and go to France before the war was ended. At any rate, when Hercules bent over me, I muttered, "I wish the pater would bump off." He leaned toward me with a smile and whispered, "You begin your postulancy well, my son," then held his hand out to me, signifying that I should return his clasp with both of mine. As I put out my hands to take his, I saw by my wristwatch that it was exactly 12:30. What followed was the wildest party I had ever seen or dreamt of. The farmhouse windows had been boarded up in curtain, and inside the rooms were literally ablaze with light. Men and women, some draped in their red dominoes, some in evening dress, some naked as the moment that they first drew breath, mingled in a perfect saturnalia of unrestrained solicity. On tables stood ice buckets with champagne, and beside them tall decanters of cut glass, filled with port and sherry, Tokay, Madeira, Muscatel, and Malaga. Also there was bottled brandy, vodka, and whiskey, trays of cigarettes, boxes of cigars, sandwiches, cakes, and sweetmeats. It was like the carnival at New Orleans, only 10 times gayer, madder, more abandoned. I was grasped by naked men and women, whirled furiously around in a wild dance, then let go only to be seized by some new partner and spun around until I almost fell from dizziness. Between times I drank, mixing wine and spirits without thought, stuffed sandwiches and cakes and candy in my mouth, and drank fresh draughts of chilled champagne or sharp-toned brandy. Staggering drunk about the table, I was reaching for another glass when I felt a hand upon my shoulder. Turning, I beheld a pair of flashing eyes laughing at me through the peepholes of a mask. "Come with me, my neophyte," the masked girl whispered. "There is still a chalice you have left untasted." She pulled me through the crowd, led me up the stairs, and thrust a door ajar. The little room we entered was entirely oriental. A Persian lamp hung like a blazing ruby from the ceiling. On the floor were thick soft rugs and piles of down-filled pillows. There was no other furniture. With a laugh, she turned her back to me, motioning me to slip the knot which held the girdle of her domino. Then she bent her head while I withdrew the pins that held her hair. It rippled in a cascade to her waist, below, nearly to her knees, black and glossy as the plumage of a grackle's throat, and as it cataract down, she swung around, shrugging her shoulders quickly, and let the scarlet domino fall from her. An upswing of her hand displaced the black-faced, purple-grinning mask, and I looked directly in the face of the pale girl who half an hour earlier had lain upon the altar of the devil. "Kiss me," she commanded. "Kiss me." Her arms were tied about my neck, pulling my lips to hers, drawing her slender, unclothed body tight against me. Her lips clung to my mouth as though they were a pair of scarlet leeches. Through her half-closed lids, I saw the glimmer of her bright black eyes,
burning like twin points of quenchless fire. It was daylight when we reached the dorm next day, and all of us reported sick at chapel. Sometime about 11, as I rose to get a drink of water, a knock came at my door. It was a telegram that stated, "Father dropped dead in his study at 12:45. Come, Mother." I hurried back to school as soon as possible. My father's death had started, frightened me, but I put it down to coincidence. He'd been suffering from Bright's disease for several years, and probably his number just turned up, I told myself. Besides, the longing for the celebration of the sacrilegious mass with its sensual stimulation, followed by the orgiastic parties, had me in a grip as strong as that which opium exerts upon its addicts. Twice a week, each Wednesday and Friday, my three friends and I attended the salacious services held in the old farmhouse cellar, followed by the revels in the upper rooms. And bit by bit we learned about our fellow cultists. Hercules, the head and center of the cult, was a priest stripped of his orders. Pastor of a parish in the suburbs of Vienna, he had dabbled in the black arts, seduced a number of his congregation from their faith, finally celebrated the black mass. The ecclesiastical authorities unfrocked him, the civil government jailed him on a morals charge, but disgrace could not impair his splendid education or his brilliant mind, and as soon as his imprisonment was over, he emigrated to America and at once secured a post as teacher. Though his talents were unquestionable, his morals were not, and scandal followed every post he held. He was at the end of his string when he managed to worm his way into the Horton trustee's confidence and secured the post left vacant by the former headmaster's entrance in the army. Our companion devil worshippers were mostly college and preparatory students, looking for a thrill not tangled in the net of fascination that the cult spun round its devotees. But a few of them were simply vicious, while others turned to demonolatry because they had lost faith in God. One of these was Mareshka Nurmi, the girl who acted as a living altar. She was my constant partner at the orgies, and bit by bit I learned her history. Only 19, she was a victim of a heart affection, and the doctors gave her but a year to live. When they pronounced sentence, she was almost prostrated. Then in desperation, she turned to religion, going every day to church and spending hours on her knees in private prayer. But medical examination showed her illness was progressing, and when she chanced to hear of Hercules' devil cult, she came to it. "I'm too young, too beautiful to die," she told me as we lay locked in each other's arms one night. "Why should God take my life? I never injured him." "All right. If he won't save me, Satan will. He'll give me life and happiness and power. Let me live for years and years. Keep me young and beautiful when all these sniveling Christian girls are old and faded. What do I care if I go to hell to pay for it? I'll take my heaven here on earth, and when the bill's presented, I won't welch." There's an old saying that each time God makes a beautiful woman, the devil opens a new page in his ledger. He must have had to put in a whole set of books when Mareshka was converted to our cult. She was attractive as a witch, had no more conscience than a snake, and positively burned with ardor to do evil. Night after night, she brought new converts to the cult. Sometimes young men, sometimes girls. "Come on, you little fool," I heard her urge a girl who shrank from the wild orgy following initiation. "Take off your robe. That's what we're here for. This is our religion, the oldest in the world. It's revolt against the goody-goodies, revolt against the narrowness of God. We live for pleasure and unbridled passion instead of abnegation and renunciation. Life and love and pleasure in a world of vivid scarlet, instead of fear and dreariness in a world all cold and gray. That's our creed and faith. We're set apart. We're marked for pleasure, we worshippers of Satan." "Tiens." "The lady was a competent saleswoman," the Grand Dame murmured. "Did she realize her dreams?" The laugh that prefaced Balderson's reply was like the echo of a chuckle in a vaulted tomb. "I don't know if she got her money's worth, but certainly she paid," he answered. It was nearing graduation time, and the celebrations were about to stop until the fall, for it would be impossible to keep the farmhouse windows shuttered
so they show no gleam of light, especially with so many people on the roads in summer. Hercules had just completed invocation, raised a chalice overhead and set it on Maryska's breast, when we saw her twitch convulsively. The little whimpering animal cry she'd always made when the climax of the obscene parody was reached gave way to a choked gasping, and we saw the hand that clutched the altar table suddenly relaxed. She raised her head and stared round the chapel with a look that sent a chill of horror rippling through me, then cried out in a strangled voice, "O Lord, be pitiful." Then she fell back on the coffin pall that draped the altar, and her fingers dangled loosely on its edge, her feet uncrossed, and lay beside each other. Hercules was going on as if nothing had happened, but the woman who sat next to me let out a sudden wail. "Look at her!" she screamed. "Look at her face!" Maryska's head had turned a little on to one side, and we saw her features in the altar candle's light. Her dark hair had come unbound and fell about her face as though it sought to hide it. Her eyes were not quite closed, nor fully open, for a thread of gray eyeball was visible between the long black lashes. Her mouth was partly open, not as though she breathed through it, but lax, slack, as though she were exhausted. Where a line of white defined the lower teeth, we saw her tongue had fallen forward, lying level with a full red lip. Somewhere in the rear of the chapel, another woman's voice, shrilly pitched but controlled, cried out, "She's dead!" There was a wave of movement in the worshippers. Chairs were overturned, gowns rustled, whispered questions buzzed like angry bees. Then the woman sitting next to me screamed again, "This is no natural death! No illness killed her. She's been stricken dead for sacrilege. She sacrificed for our sins. Fly, fly, before the wrath of God blast all of us." Hercules stood at the altar facing us, a mask as of some inner feeling of strange forbidden passions, of things that raced on scurrying feet within his brain, seemed to drop across his features. His face seemed odd and ancient, yet at the same time ageless. His eyes took on a glaze like polished agate. He raised both hands above his head, the fingers flexed like talons, and laughed as if some dark jest known only to himself. "Whoso leaves the temple of his Lord without partaking of this most unholy sacrament, the same will Satan cast aside, defenseless from the vengeance of an outraged God," he cried. Then I knew. Carl Erich Hercules, renegade Christian priest, brilliant scholar, poisoner of souls, and votary of Satan, was mad as any Tom of Bedlam. He stood there by the devil's altar, hurling curses at us, threatening us with heaven's vengeance, casting an anathema upon us with such vile insults and filthy language as a fishwife would not dare to use. But panic had the congregation by the throat. They pushed and fought and scratched and bit like frenzied cats, clawing and slashing at one another till they had gained the exit, then rushing pell-mell down the hill to their parked cars without a backward look, leaving Hercules alone and beside the altar he had raised to Satan with the dead girl stretched upon it. There was no chance that Hercules would help. He kept reciting passages from the Black Mass, genuflecting to the altar, filling and refilling the wine cup and stuffing his mouth with the wafers meant to parody the host. So Trivers, Eldridge, Atkins, and I took Maryska's body to the river, weighted it with window irons, and dropped it in the water. But the knots we tied must have been loose, or else the weights were insufficient, for as we turned to leave, her body boated almost to the surface, and one white arm raised above the river's glassy face, as though to wave a mute farewell. It must have been a trick the current played as the tide bore her away, but to us it seemed that her dead hand pointed to us each in turn. Certainly there was no doubt it bobbed four times above the river's surface before the swirling waters sucked it out of sight. You've probably heard garbled rumors of what happened afterward. The farmhouse burnt that night, and because there was no water to be had, there was no salvage. Still, a few things were not utterly destroyed, and people in the neighborhood still wonder how those Persian lamps and brazen candlesticks came to be in that deserted house. Hercules committed suicide that night, and when the auditors went over his accounts, they found he'd practically wrecked Horton. There was hardly a cent left, for he'd financed his whole grisly farce of devil worship with the money he embezzled. The trustees made the losses good and gave up in disgust. Ours was the last class graduated. They found Maryska's body floating in the Shrewsbury 2 days later, and at first the coroner was sure she'd been the victim of a murder, for while the window weights had fallen off, the cords that tied them were still knotted round her ankles. When the autopsy disclosed she had not been drowned, but had been put into the river after death from heart disease, the mystery was deepened. But until tonight, only 4 people knew its answer. Now, there are only 3.
3, monsieur? De Grandin asked.
That's right. Trivers, Atkins, and Eldridge are dead. I'm still here, and you, and Dr. Trowbridge.
Your figures are at fault, my friend. You forget we are physicians, and your narrative was given us in confidence.
But see here, I asked, as the silence lengthened, what is there about all this to make you want to kill yourself? If you'd been grown men when you joined these devil worshippers, it would have been more serious. But college boys are always in some sort of mischief, and this all happened 20 years ago. You say you are sincerely sorry for it, and after all, the leaders in the movement died, so...
Balderson broke through my moralizing with a short, hard laugh.
Men die more easily than memories, doctor. Besides...
Yes, monsieur, besides, de Grandin prompted, as our guest stared silently into the study fire.
Do you believe the spirits of the dead, die dead, who are in hell, or at least cut off from heaven, can come back to plague the living? He demanded.
De Grandin brushed the ends of his small, waxen mustache with that gesture which always reminded me of a tomcat combing his whiskers.
You have experienced such a visitation?
I have. So did the others.
Mon Dieu, how was it?
You may remember reading that Ted Eldridge hanged himself. 3 days before it happened, he met me on the street, and I could see that he was almost frantic.
I saw Maryska last night, he told me, in a frightened whisper.
Maryska? You must be off your rocker, man. We put her in the Shrewsbury.
And she's come back again. Remember the perfume of the candles and the incense Hercules used in celebrating the Black Mass? I'd come home from New York last night and was getting ready for a drink before I went to bed. When I began to smell it, at first I thought it was some fool trick that my senses played on me, but the scent kept getting stronger. It seemed as if I were back in that dreadful chapel with the tall black candles burning, the hellish incense smoldering, Hercules in his red vestments and Maryska lying naked on the altar. I could almost hear the chanting of inverted prayers and the little whimpering noises that she made. I gulped my drink down in 2 swallows and turned around. She was standing there, with water on her face and streaming from her hair, and her hands held out to me.
You're crazy as a goat, I told him. Come have a drink.
He looked at me a moment, then turned away, walking quickly down the street and muttering to himself. I'd not have thought so much about it if I hadn't read about his suicide next day, and if Stanley Trivers hadn't called me on the telephone.
Hear about Ted Eldridge? He asked. I had said, hello.
When I told him I just read about it, he demanded, did you see him recently?
Yes, ran into him in Broad Street yesterday, I answered.
Seemed worried, didn't he? Did he tell you anything about Maryska?
Say, what is this? I asked. Did he say anything to you?
Yes, he did. And I thought he had a belfry full of bats.
There's not much doubt the poor old lad was cuckoo.
That's where you're mistaken, Balderson. According to the paper, he'd been dead for something like 4 hours when they found him. That would have made it something like 4 o'clock when he died.
So what?
So this. I waked up at 4 o'clock this morning, and the room was positively stifling with the odor of the incense they used in the Black Chapel.
Yeah?
I suppose you saw Maryska too?
I did. She was standing by my bed, with water streaming from her face and body, and tears were in her eyes. I tried to talk him out of it, tell him that it was a trick of his imagination stimulated by Ted Eldred's wild talk, but he insisted that he'd really seen her. 2 days later, he committed suicide. Don Atkins followed. I didn't talk with him before he shot himself, but I'll wager that he saw her too and smelled that devil's incense. The Grand Dan looked at me with upraised brows, then shook his head to caution silence. Here he turned to face our guests. "And you, monsieur?" he asked. "Yes, I too. Don killed himself sometime in early afternoon. I was home that day. I'd say that it was shortly after 2, for I'd lunch at the City Club and come home to pack a bag and take a trip to Nantucket. I had the highboy open and was taking some shirts when I began to notice a strange odor in the air. But it wasn't strange for long. As it grew stronger, I recognized it as the scent of Herbule's incense. It grew so strong that it was almost overpowering. I stood there by the chest of drawers, smelling the increasing scent, and determined that I'd not turn around. You know how Coleridge put it? Like one that on a lonesome road doth walk in fear and dread, and having once turned round walks on, and turns no more his head, because he knows a frightful fiend doth close behind him tread. The odor of the incense grew until I could have sworn somebody swung a censer right behind me. Then suddenly, I heard the sound of falling water. Drip, drip, drip. It fell upon the floor, drop by deliberate drop. The suspense was more than I could bear, and I wheeled about. Maryska stood behind me, almost close enough to touch. Water trickled from the hair that hung in gleaming strands across her breast and shoulders. It hung in little gleaming globules on her pale, smooth skin, ran in little rivulets across her forehead, down her beautifully shaped legs, made tiny puddles on the polished floor besides each slim, bare foot. I went almost sick with horror as I saw the knotted cords we'd used to tie the window weights on her sill about her ankles, water oozing from their coils. She did not seem dead. Her lovely, slender body seemed as vital as when I had held it in my arms. Her full and mobile lips were red with rouge. Her eyes were neither set and staring nor expressionless, but they were sad, immeasurably sad. They seemed to probe into my spirit's very depth, asking, beseeching, entreating. And to make their plea more eloquent, she slowly raised her lovely hands and held them out to me, palms up, fingers slightly curled, as though she besought alms. There was a faint resemblance to her bitter, crooked smile upon her lips, but it was so sad, so hopelessly entreating, that it almost made me weep to see it. "Mar," I began, but the name stuck in my throat. This couldn't be the body that I'd held against my heart. Those lips were not the lips I'd kissed 1,000 times. This was no girl of flesh and blood. Maryska lay deep in a grave in Shadow Lawn Cemetery, had lain there almost 20 years. Dust had filled those sad, entreating eyes long before the college freshmen of this year were born. The worms. Somewhere I had heard that if you called upon the Trinity, a ghost would vanish. "In the name of the Father," I began, but it seemed as if a clap of thunder sounded in my ears. "What right have you to call upon the true God?" a mighty voice seemed asking. "You who have mocked at heaven, taken every sacred name in vain, made a jest of every holy thing. How dare you invoke deity? Your sacrilegious lips cannot pronounce the sacred name." And it was true. I tried again, but the words clogged in my throat. I tried to force them out, but only strangling inarticulacy sounded. Maryska's smile was almost pityingly tender, but still she stood there, pleading, entreating, begging me, though what it was she wanted I could not divine. I threw my arms across my eyes to shut the vision out, but when I took it down, she was still there, and still the water dripped from her entreating hands, ran in little courses from her dankly hanging hair, fell drop by drop from the sopping cords that ringed her ankles. I stumbled blindly from the house and walked the street for hours. Presently, I bought a paper, and the headlines told me Donald Atkins had been found, a suicide in his apartment. When I reached my house again, the incense still hung in the air, but the vision of Maryska was not there. I drank almost a pint of brandy neat and fell across my bed. When I recovered from my alcoholic stupor, Maryska stood beside me, her great eyes luminous with tears, her hands outstretched in mute entreaty. She's been with me almost every waking instant since that night. I drank myself into oblivion, but every time I sobered, she was standing by me. I'd walked the streets for hours, but every time I halted, she would be there, always silent, always with her hands held out, always with that look of supplication in her tear-filled eyes. I'd rush at her and try to drive her off with blows and kicks. She seemed to float away, staying just outside my reach, however savagely I ran at her. And though I cursed her using every foul word I knew, she never changed expression, never showed resentment, just stood and looked at me with sad, imploring eyes, always seeming to be begging me for something. I can't endure it any longer, gentlemen. Tonight, she stood beside me when I was halted on Northbridge, and I'd have been at peace by now if you'd not come along.
No, there you are mistaken, mon ami, the Grandin contradicted. Had you carried your intention out and leaped into the river, you would have sealed your doom irrevocably. Instead of leaving her, you would have joined her for eternity.
All right, Balderson asked raspingly. I suppose you have a better plan?
I think I have, the little Frenchman answered. First, I would suggest you let us give you sedatives. You will not be troubled while you sleep, and while you rest, we shall be active.
Shakespeare was right, I said as we left our patients sleeping from a dose of chloral hydrate. Conscience does make cowards of us all. The memory of that early indiscretion has haunted the quarter of worthless youngsters 20 years. No wonder they kept seeing that poor girl after they'd thrown her so callously into the Shrewsbury. Of all the heartless, despicable things. He emerged from a brown study long enough to interrupt. And is your conscience clean, my friend?
What has my conscience to do with it? I didn't throw a dead girl in the river. I didn't...
Precisamente, neither did the good Costello.
Yet both of you described the odor of that devil's incense.
Costello, when he went to view the bodies of the suicides. You, when we halted Monsieur Balderson's attempt at self-destruction. Were you also haunted by that scent, or were you not?
I smelled it, I responded frigidly, but I wasn't haunted by it.
Just what is it you're driving at? That the odor of that incense, or even the perception of the dead Maryska's revenant, is no optical illusion caused by guilty conscience. It is my firm conviction that the apparition which appeared to these unfortunate young men was the earthbound spirit of a girl who begged a boon from them.
Then you don't think that she haunted them because they'd thrown her body in the river?
Entirely no. I think she came to ask their help. And in their fear and horror at beholding her, they could not understand her plea. First one and then another, lashed with the scorpion whip of an accusing conscience, destroyed himself because he dared not look into the pleading eyes, thinking they accused him of mistreating her poor body, when all the poor creature asked was that they help her to secure release from her earthbound condition.
Why should she have appealed to them?
In all that congregation of benighted worshippers of evil, she knew them best. They saw her die, they gave her body sepulchre. One of them, at least, had been her lover, and was presumably bound to her by ties of mutual passion. She was most strongly in their minds and memories. It was but natural that she should appeal to them for succor. Did you not notice an outstanding fact in all the testimony? The poor Maryska appeared to them in turn, looking not reproachfully, but pleadingly. Her lips were held. She might not put her plea in words. She could but come to them as they had last beheld her, entreat them by dumb show, and hope that they would understand. One by one they failed her. One by one they failed to understand.
Well, is there anything that we can do about it?
I think there is.
Come, let us be on our way.
Where the deuce?
To the rectory of St. Chrysostom. I would interview the Reverend Dr. Bentley.
At this time of night?
Ma certainement, clergymen and doctors, they have no privacy, my friend. Surely you need not be told that.
The freshly lighted fire burned brightly in the Reverend Peter Bentley's study. The blue smoke spiraled upward from the tips of our cigars. The gray steam curled in fragrant clouds from the glasses of hot scotch which stood upon the coffee table. Looking anything but clerical in red flannel bathrobe, black pajamas, and red Turkish slippers, Dr. Bentley listened with surprising tolerance to de Grandin's argument. "But it seems the poor girl died in mortal sin," he murmured, obviously more in sorrow than in righteous indignation. "According to your statement, her last frantic words called on the devil to fulfill his bargain. O Lord, be pitiful."
"Precisement, mon père. But who can say her prayer was made to Satan?
True, those so bewildered, misled followers of evil were wont to call the devil Lord and Master. But is it not entirely possible that she repented and addressed her dying prayer to the real Lord of the heaven and earth? Somewhere an English poet says of the last-minute prayer of an unholy righteous fox-hunter who was unhorsed and broke his sinful neck, betwixt the stirrup and the ground, I mercy asked, mercy I found.
Me, I believe in all sincerity that her repentance was as true as that the thief upon the cross expressed, that in the last dread moment she perceived the grievous error of her ways and made at once confession of sin and prayer for pity with her dying breath. But she had bent the knee at Satan's shrine with her fair body, that body which was given her to wear, as if it were a garment to the greater glory of the Lord. She parried the sacred fair cloth of the altar. By such things she had cut herself adrift. She had put herself beyond communion with the righteous, which is the blessed company of all the faithful. There was no priest to shrive her unencumbered soul, no one to read words of forgiveness and redemption above her lifeless clay, until some of her companions in iniquity will perform the service of contrition for her. Until the office of the burial of Christian dead is read above her grave, she lies excommunicate and earthbound. She cannot even expiate her faults in purgatory till forgiveness of sins has been formally pronounced. Sincerely repentant, hell is not for her. Unshrived and with no formal statement of conditional forgiveness, she cannot quit the earth, but must wander here among the scenes of her brief and sadly misspent life. Do we dare withhold our hand to save her from a fate like that? Dr. Bentley sipped thoughtfully at his hot scotch.
There may be something in your theory, he admitted. I'm not especially strong on doctrine, but I can't believe the fathers of the early church, or the crude nincompoop some of our modern theologians call them. They preach posthumous absolution, and there are instances recorded where excommunicated persons who had hovered round the scenes they'd known in life were given rest and peace when absolution was pronounced above their graves. Tell me, is this Balderson sincerely sorry for his misdeeds?
I could swear it, mon père.
Then bring him to the chapel in the morning. If he will make confession and declare sincere repentance, then submit himself to holy baptism, I'll do what you request. It's rather medieval, but I'd hate to think that I'm so modern that I would not take a chance to save two souls.
The penitential service in the chapel of the Intercession was a brief but most impressive one. Only Balderson, I, and de Grandin occupied the pews, with Dr. Bailey in his stolen cassock, but without his surplice at the little altar.
We have followed too much the devices and desires of our own hearts. We have offended against thy holy laws. Remember not, Lord, our offenses, nor the offenses of our forefathers, neither take thou vengeance of our sins. We acknowledge and bewail our manifold sins and wickedness. The memory of them is grievous unto us. The burden of them is intolerable. After absolution followed the short service, ordered for the baptism of adults, then we set out for Shadow Lawns. Now Dr. Bailey wore his full canonicals and his surplice glinted almost whiter than the snow that wrapped the mounded graves as he paused beside an unmarked hillock in the Normie family plot. Slowly he began, in that low, full voice, with what he fills a great church to its farthest corner. I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. It was one of those still winter days, quieter than an afternoon in August, for no chirp of bird or whir of insect sounded. No breath of breeze disturbed the evergreens. Yet as he read the opening sentence of the office for the burial of the dead, a low wail sounded in the copse of yew and hemlock on the hill, as though a sudden wind moaned in the branches, and I stiffened as a scent was borne across the snow-capped grave mounds. Incense. Yet not exactly incense, either. There was an undertone of fetor in it, a faint, distinctly charnel smell. Balderson was trembling, and despite myself, I flinched. But Dr. Bentley and de Grandin gave no sign of recognition. Thou knowest, Lord, the secrets of our hearts. Shut not thy merciful ears to our prayers of spare us, Lord most holy, intoned the clergyman. And, Amen, said Jules de Grandin, firmly, as the prayer concluded. The Aeolian wailing in the evergreens died to a sobbing, low clamation as Dr. Bailey traced in sand a cross upon the snow-capped grave, declaring, Unto Almighty God we commend the soul of our departed sister, and we commit her body to the ground, earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and the sure and certain hope of the resurrection into eternal life. And now there was no odor of corruption in the ghostly perfume, but the clean, inspiring scent of frankincense, redolent of worship at a thousand consecrated altars. As the last amen was said and Dr. Bailey turned away, I could have sworn I heard a gentle slapping sound and saw the blonde hairs of de Grandin's small mustache bent inward, as though a pair of lips invisible to me had kissed him on the mouth. Dr. Bentley dined with us that night, and over coffee and liquors we discussed the case. It was a fine thing you did, the cleric told de Grandin. 6 men in 7 would have sent him packing and bid him work out his salvation, or damnation, for himself. There's an essential nastiness in double worship, which is revolting to the average man, not to mention its abysmal wickedness. Tiens, who of us can judge another's wickedness? The little Frenchman answered. The young man was repentant, and repentance is the purchase price of heavenly forgiveness. Besides, a look of strain like an nostalgic longing came into his eyes. Before the altar of a convent in La Belle, France, kneels one whom I have loved as I can never love another in this life. Ceaselessly, except the little time she sleeps, she makes prayer and intercession for a sinful world. Could I hold fast the memory of our love if I refused to match in works the prayer she makes in faith? Eh bien, mon père. My inclination was to give him a smart kick in the posterior, to bid him go and sin no more, but sinfully or otherwise to go. Ha! I am strong. I overcame that inclination. The earnestness of his expression faded, and an impish grin replaced it as he poured a liberal potion of Napoleon 1811 in his brandy sniffer. Jules de Grandin, he apostrophized himself, you have acted like a true man. You have overcome your natural desires. You have kept the faith. Jules de Grandin, my good and much admired self, be pleased to take a drink.